This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
They're against liberal democracy, against the protection of minority rights, against pluralism, and those are core issues of what we consider to be our democratic system.
Professor Kasmuda has been studying the far right in Europe since the 1980s. He's an expert on something he always said wasn't that big a deal.
I made my career telling people that they were over-concerned and that the far right wasn't that important.
But now he's changed his mind.
Now the debate is absolutely dominated by immigration, crime, terrorism, and the inability of the EU to deal with it, which is exactly what they're saying for years. They're no longer the margin or a niche. It is very much part of the political mainstream. They're riding a perfect storm, and it seems that people are less concerned about them now.
He'll be joining us in the briefing room to chart the rise of the politicians who are proud to call themselves illiberal Democrats. But first, the most recent and most visible manifestation of the new illiberal Democrats, the referendum on migrants' quotas this weekend, called by Hungary's Prime Minister. The BBC's Nick Thorpe has followed the rise of the country's radical and far right.
I am the mayor of Ashdod-Tulon. We welcome everyone who respects our laws and enters our country through our international border crossing point. But from now on, the borders are protected by thousands of police and by the Hungarian army.
At the start of the refugee crisis in Hungary in February 2015, I sat down with Laszlo Torockai, one of the bad boys of the far right in Hungary, to talk about migrants. This is a man who used to block bridges and confront the police in Budapest when the Socialist Liberal Coalition were in power. Now he's the mayor of the sprawling village of Ashotalom on Hungary's southern border with Serbia, representing the nationalist Jobbik Party, right at the centre of a roughly 25-kilometre bottleneck through which already thousands, later hundreds of thousands, of migrants and refugees were streaming into Hungary. "Don't you feel sorry for them?" I asked. "Of course I do," he said, "but my first responsibility is to my constituents. All night the migrants knock on their doors, set the dogs barking, ask for water or food and break into empty houses. If there's a war in their countries, they should go home and liberate their own lands, not trample through ours." "How do you want to keep them out?" I asked. "Build a big fence, deploy the army, recreate the border guard," he suggested. 18 months on, Prime Minister Viktor Orban's right-wing Fidesz government has done almost everything Laszlo Torockai advised. But the mayor's Jobbik party has evolved into the biggest challenger to his government. More than 200 kilometres of razor wire fence are in place along the southern borders, and the Prime Minister has spoken of building a second, even stronger barrier beside it. The difference between this fence and the Iron Curtain, which used to divide East from Western Europe, the Prime Minister says, is that this Iron Curtain is for us. The other one was against us. But what exactly is he trying to defend? In July 2014, Viktor Orbán spelt out his vision of Hungary as an illiberal democracy. There is today, he said, at an annual student gathering in Transylvania, where he likes to articulate his views, a race to invent a state that is most capable of making a nation successful. He admires countries like Russia, Singapore, China, and Turkey, which can hardly be described as liberal democracies, yet are economically successful. We are searching, he continued in the same speech, for ways of parting with Western European dogmas, to organize our community in a way to make ourselves competitive in this great world race. And those Western European dogmas include human rights, civil liberties, and a system of checks and balances. These are unnecessary constraints, he believes, on the exercise of power for the common good. If Donald Trump wants to make America great again, Viktor Orban wants to make Hungary great again. While once Mr. Orban was an anti-communist, now he's an anti-liberal. Only a month after that speech, Viktor Orban addressed his own diplomats at their annual gathering in Budapest. Hungary's attitude to immigration should be as hard as stone, the Prime Minister told them, because it sees no value in breaking up a homogeneous society. The immigration policy of the European Union, by contrast, he said, is hypocritical, lacking moral foundations, and purposeless. The fact that Hungary is still a largely homogeneous society and should be kept that way is central to both the Fidesz and the Jobbik vision. Only 1.7% of Hungarians were born outside the European Union, while the figure in many West European countries, including the United Kingdom, is over 8%. Hungarians have little experience of living with foreigners, and they're afraid of the unknown. It's an easy fear for populist politicians to play on. They believe Europe is littered with no-go zones where pale-skinned people fear to tread. In their campaign for this referendum, every household received a slickly produced booklet on the disastrous effect immigration has had on Western Europe.
There's a leaflet in your referendum campaign, and it tells the Hungarian people that there are several hundred no-go areas in Europe where migrants have taken over and people can't get. I think there are about a dozen, you say, in the UK, because you mark them, I think, in Peterborough, London, Southampton. Do you believe that claim?
Well, actually, we...
When the BBC's Evan Davis challenged the Hungarian Foreign Minister, Péter Szijjártó, on these no-go zones on Newsnight, Mr. Szijjártó replied that this was a well-known fact.
There are no-go zones in Europe, and we don't want no-go zones in Hungary for sure.
Despite that, the referendum failed, while almost all those who voted were on Mr. Orbán's side. 50% turnout was needed for the referendum to be valid, and it wasn't. In a bizarre and almost Orwellian speech on Sunday night, Viktor Orban claimed victory nonetheless. He would continue his fight against migrant quotas in Brussels, he said, and represent the 3 million people who voted no to migrants in this referendum. He wants to be the champion of all those who think Europe should be a fortress, not a safe haven. Which brings us back to the idea of illiberal democracy. Liberalism is an obsession of the intellectuals, he believes, and as a man of humble origins, he likes to play the proletarian. Keep the consumers happy with state intervention, for example, to keep utility bills down, and plenty of pork and pálinka, the excellent Hungarian brandy. As a champion of Hungarian identity, state contracts should go to Hungarian businessmen, he believes, especially those oligarchs in his inner circle.
The Prime Minister is actually happy about the arrival of all these refugees in Europe, Gergely Kovács, leader of the satirical twin-tailed dog party, told me, because it gives him a new enemy. First he hated liberals, then gays, then banks, then Brussels. Now he hates migrants.
That was Nick Thorpe, the BBC's Central Europe correspondent. With me in the briefing room to discuss liberal democracy and the European right are Professor Kaz Muda from the University of Georgia, Daphne Halikiopoulou from the University of Reading, and the BBC's Chris Bowlby. First of all, Kaz Muda, tell us a bit more about Hungary's Prime Minister, Viktor Orbán. What is so significant about him?
The most significant thing about him is that he by and large advances
an illiberal democratic agenda, an increasingly radical right agenda from within the European mainstream. He is not a politician which fits the usual suspect of the radical right like Marine Le Pen. He is actually a politician who is still broadly perceived as conservative and who is a member of the European People's Party, which is the group of center-right parties within the European Parliament and by far the most dominant political group.
Is that the one that Angela Merkel's in?
Exactly. And that is the irony of today's politics, is that the most fundamental battle in Europe today is fought between Angela Merkel in Germany and Viktor Orban in Hungary, who are both members of the same political group in Brussels.
You talk about him being part of the mainstream and him being a centre-right figure. Can you chart for me, if you like, his political development?
So he emerged in the last years of communism in Hungary, 1987, 1988, when he was one of the founders of Fidesz, which at that point in time was a liberal party, a party of the youth. He studied at Oxford University on a scholarship from George Soros, who has now become one of his main targets. And then they had this party, which did decently in the first elections after the fall of communism. But then he moved into the conservative spot because a previous party, the MDF, the Hungarian Democratic Forum, had kind of dissolved. And so Orban saw a space there, a space for a conservative party, what you call one nation conservatism in Britain, which had a national to nationalist orientation.
One nation conservatism, that's when the rich look after the poor and we're all in it together.
He kept that until he lost power. And then when he came back in 2010, he became much more outspoken illiberal.
Now, can you just take us through the characteristics of the Orbán government that distinguish it, let's say, from a conventional centre-right conservative government in Europe?
Traditionally, he is much less a supporter of the free market than conservative parties are. He believes more in a kind of a national capitalism, where the state is very much guiding the capitalist system, not so much to redistribute wealth, but because of the history of communism, Hungary is lacking a bourgeoisie, which is necessary for a capitalist system to survive. So the state is creating that, and it's creating that pretty much through Orbán cronies. He also does not really believe in individual freedoms, believes that the collective, the nation, is more important, and believes that pluralism is undermining the strength of the nation and of the state.
Now, and by pluralism, we mean the existence and the tolerance of very many different points of view within the system.
Exactly. And so what he has done is he has reformed the system in which almost all the powers of independent organizations have been limited, including the Constitutional Court, in which he has put his own people in positions that also are extending well beyond the legislative term. So some of the positions are for 7 or 8 years, which means that once Orbán might lose power, which is very difficult these days through elections, he would still hold a lot of political power through these appointed positions.
What's he done about the media?
Well, the media has been streamlined, but not in the old-fashioned way where you just ban media or fire everyone who says something negative. He does it through economic means, which is a strategy that Putin has also used in Russia. Most media are completely dependent upon state contracts these days in Hungary. And to get money from the state, campaigns or whatever, you have to be pro-Orban.
Chris Bowlby, you've studied the far right in Europe and been looking at these developments. Liberal democracies, we've heard, is Viktor Orban's phrase. Who else could we apply it to in Europe?
Well, I think there is a concentration at the moment on that Central European area, a group of countries which were seen as having, after the end of communism in 1989, embraced the deal, if you like, in terms of liberal internationalism, joined the EU and so on. And Orbán would have been seen in his time as a bright young thing representing precisely that move away from communism into the new era. Poland would obviously attract a lot of attention, and there would be elements of the way in which the Law and Justice Party is behaving now towards the courts, towards the media, representing what it sees as very much a defence of the nation.
This is the ruling party now in Poland.
The ruling party, not in as strong a position as Orbán is in Hungary, and are subject to political opposition, popular opposition, you might say. But they would certainly be similar in the ways in which they would talk about using the state to defend the nation, not being bound by what they would see as outside rules and regulations that might be seen as the liberal international norms, standing up for the reputation of the state, the history of the state even, and challenging not only judicial freedoms, media freedoms, also academic freedoms, in trying to shape the way the state's history is presented.
So quite interventionist, really, in terms of what they want people to be able to say and do.
Well, certainly that's right. As Kaz was indicating, it's interesting is the idea of, rather than shouting from the outside, shouting abuse, but using power in your own particular way. And I think also a very interesting grouping, which we might bear in mind here, the Poles, the Hungarians, the Czechs and the Slovaks, so-called Visegrad group, who have been really flexing their muscles within the European Union over the migration crisis. Previously, a rather more passive group had come in after 1989, and you have figures also within the Czech Republic and Slovakia who would echo these sorts of things.
Daphne, you've studied the far-right groups across Europe as well. I've heard people talk about the 30s coming back. Do you think there is such a far-right breakthrough happening across the continent?
I think we can certainly find some parallels. So, you know, the far right has been doing increasingly well in Western Europe as well. You've been talking about Eastern Europe so far. But if we look at, say, the European Parliament elections in 2014, many far-right parties in Western Europe, the Front National, the Austrian FPÖ, also in Scandinavia, the Golden Dawn in Greece, the Dutch PVV, they've all done quite well in terms of electoral support. So I'd certainly say there is an increasing trend that these ideas are becoming more and more popular, although I'd also, you know, make distinctions between what all these parties say. If you look at the Western European far-right that's been doing quite well, in a way what their agenda is to distance themselves from fascism and, you know, from clear biological justifications of exclusion. And instead,
you mean essentially classic racism?
Exactly. So instead of saying, you know, we want to exclude a particular group of people because of their race or because of their ethnic descent, now they say they use ideological justification. So they say, you know, we exclude these people on the basis of toleration because they and their illiberal ideas are actually intolerant of the very liberal values that our Western democratic societies rest on.
Essentially, they're talking about Muslims here, aren't they?
Yes.
The kind of concepts of Muslims. Grace Bobby, do you feel that this is the same far right that we've seen throughout the last 100 years, just sort of come back in a mildly different form? Every now and again, you get a crisis, you get a bit of a far right, crisis goes, they go.
Well, a lot of people, when they hear the phrase far right, will immediately think Nazism, neo-Nazism, the fascist period. And clearly there was a period after the Second World War when those who had a nostalgia for that, a very tiny group, would be dressing up in the old clothes and singing the old songs and shouting from the sidelines. Only ever able, if they did stand for election at all, to achieve a few percentage points. But the striking thing is that some of those groups, a decision was taken, if you like, or a leadership emerged that suggested that if they could pitch more towards the centre and jettison what was seen as some of the most off-putting aspects of that kind of politics, there was an opportunity there for them. And also, of course, embracing the anti-Muslim agenda was a way of finding a substitute for what might have been anti-Semitism in the past, which was still a great taboo. So you would see a phenomenon whereby some of the people involved in this politics would make a conscious effort to say, oh, we're no longer anti-Semitic, even if you go to their private meetings, you will still hear in coded form for some of the core support, some of the old slogans, some of the old references, some of the old prejudices. I mean, I've heard that, for example, Freedom Party in Austria.
So how important, Daphne, is the anti-migration theme? I mean, Are we saying that without the what is seen as a migration crisis, that the far right could not really operate at the level of success that it's been seeing recently?
When we see strict anti-immigration attitudes, we don't really know if people have got these attitudes because they fear of a cultural erosion or because they actually fear that these migrants would be accessing welfare, you know, the collective goods of the state, pensions. So I think what drives this is various forms of insecurity and policies that are exacerbating those insecurities, and obviously the parties themselves that are able to tap into these insecurities and get increasing support.
Cass Muda, is your sense that, I mean, I'll come clean about this, ever since the Cologne events in January, when, if you remember, there were these attacks by migrants and some refugees on women on New Year's Eve, I've now heard and read things from places and from people that I would never have expected to hear or read from people like that before.
I think you have to make a distinction, though, between a change in attitudes and a change in expressions. The majority of people hold prejudices, and this has always been the case. The majority of people think that there are too many immigrants. In many countries, at least a plurality think that the state is too soft on crime, all those kind of things. But there are certain events that make these issues more salient and that give the regular people, as well as so-called intellectuals, the impetus or the freedom to express them more freely. And 9/11 was, of course, a watershed moment, which made the discussion of Islam and immigration in more skeptical and negative terms much more acceptable. The refugee crisis has done this pretty much on steroids. It has dominated the agenda, and it has pretty much created a broad consensus that refugees are problematic, that they're threatening Europe. And there is a link to terrorism, which is not expressed explicitly by everyone, but to a certain extent agreed upon by everyone. When you read it everywhere, then everyone thinks, OK, I can say this.
Chris?
These movements will tend to thrive in an atmosphere of insecurity and anxiety. Insecurity, which may partly be brought about by economic events, the anxiety about migration, terrorism, above all, a sense of the pace of change. A lot of people are just stunned, don't know where to look, and they will always be very good at providing quick explanations, a sense that you can turn the clock back, and the demand for that grows at these moments when there's a feeling that change is speeding up and overwhelming.
To what extent do you think that the crash of 2008 plays a picture here? Because in one way, you can kind of paint a picture of these countries coming into the European Union, I mean, if we're talking about the countries of Eastern Europe, with an expectation of what would happen economically and so on. Major problems of transition. And then we have, and in Western Europe as well, we have the crash of 2008. Daphne?
The question is not so much about crisis itself, but actually about crisis management. What the economic crisis has shown, I think more than anything, is that the extent to which governments can limit the effect it has on the population. So if we look at, for example, economic indicators in themselves, like unemployment, we'll see that they don't really correlate with far-right party support. Some countries that have very high levels of unemployment, like Spain or Portugal, don't really have far-right party support. But if we do look at actual welfare policies, employment protection legislation, or unemployment benefits, and how these have been managed, especially during the crisis, we will see a correlation. So really, austerity does trigger party support precisely because it shows the difficulty that governments are facing in providing welfare.
There's an oddity in this, which is fairly obvious, which is that those parties which traditionally had drawn support precisely because of their opposition to austerity and their support for welfare for ordinary people have actually done incredibly badly, if not collapsed.
You can see this, for example, in Scandinavia. A moment I'll never forget, which really brought it home to me, was I went once to a meeting of the Danish People's Party, hosted by its then leader, Pia Kjærsgaard, Mama Pia, as she was known to her followers. She presented herself herself as a typical Danish housewife. It was a very nice evening, very hygge, very fashionable term at the moment, Christmas decorations, that kind of thing. And she said, I'm the sort of person who would have been a social democrat in the past and a beneficiary of the welfare state, but that's all going wrong because we're being threatened. She put it very politely when I went down the end of the room and talked to her supporters, and they put it much more bluntly, we're being outbred by the Muslims. But they have been able to direct this message, suggests that the welfare state was a definition of, in this case, Danishness. Your entitlement to it was a definition of Danishness. And these outsiders are coming in who are not entitled, but they're undermining our ability to honour our obligations to the Danish people.
On the one hand, social democratic parties in almost every country have adopted a third way type policy. That by and large accepts the market and believes that the market should get things done, which limits the power of the state. But as a consequence, it also limits the powers of politicians. And increasingly, politicians, they will say, well, this is outside of our hands because of globalization or because of the European Union or because of mass immigration. And then you look at, if you're getting desperate, you're just looking around, and then you see only pretty much one group of politicians who still say, oh no, we can do this. Like, we will use the state to stand up for you. The radical right offers to a certain extent real politics still, and they might over-offer in the sense that they claim that they can achieve things that they cannot really, like completely closed borders are impossible. But at the same time, they're so successful because most of the other parties, they will say either we can't do this or there is no alternative.
I'm bound to say that in our referendum campaign, a very popular slogan was take back control. Are you suggesting that take back control is also a kind of yearning which a lot of people have to see a government be able to do things?
Of course. And to a certain extent, why shouldn't they? We're asked to come out to vote for people who are governing us. The point is not that everyone should now be a radical right light, which seems to be increasingly what social democratic parties and center-right parties do. The point is that you should counter with a more realistic but nevertheless more proactive agenda where you say, we also can take part of the control.
Chris Welby, finally, what does it mean for the European Union?
Certainly when it comes to migration in particular, the European Union's got to take a decision as to how far it's going to go down the road permanently of more restrictions. And what will be very interesting to see too is, it's interesting if we look back to Jörg Haider, who became part of the coalition government in Austria in 2000, and that was a very interesting moment when a lot of the European Union said, right, we're going to more or less ostracise Austria because of this, we're going to take a stand. I think that's much less likely now, precisely because there is a realisation that this has, to an extent, entered the mainstream more. You have the organised parties, you have members of parliaments, you have members of assemblies. So in that sense, it actually makes it much more difficult to adopt a policy of saying we will create a border here because the thing has entered the mainstream much more.
OK, well, if I could take anything from this discussion, I think it's, firstly, what we used to call the radical right has jumped the species barrier. It's gone from being a kind of fringe thing to being something that can actually exist in power with its own philosophy. And the second thing really is that this is a kind of cultural as much as an economic phenomenon. It's a product of people's sense of dislocation and loss of confidence. The third thing really is that the mainstream parties haven't really got the faintest idea what to do about it. Chris Bobby, do you think that's a fair summary?
I think that makes a lot of sense. It's probably permanently changed the language of politics. You mentioned that it's not just a matter of economics, and that's a very important point because a lot of people might think, oh, as soon as things improve, it'll go away. Perhaps it's the case that the European Union, when it was founded, assumed that fascism was gone forever. That was almost its raison d'etre. And then when we had 1989, it brought all these countries into assumed by not being communist, they would all embrace the values of liberal internationalism. Now it's actually got to make its case.
Thanks, Chris. That's it for this week. My thanks to you and also to Dr. Daphne Halikiopoulou and Professor Cass Muda. Until next week.
Thank you for listening to The Briefing Room. It's the podcast that tells you what you need to know about what's happening now. This edition was presented by David Aronovich, researched by Kirstine Knight, and produced by me, Joe Kent. We always like to know what you think of our podcast, and the best way to tell us is to leave your feedback and to rate us on iTunes or your podcast provider. And if you want, you can email us, thebriefingroom@bbc.co.uk.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.